welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at wpvmfm.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And I want to welcome our listeners once again to A Mindful Emergence. Thank you for tuning in. And at this time, welcome my co-host, Margaret Kirshner.
Hi, happy to be here.
And also welcome our guest for this week. We're very fortunate to have in the studios Michael Fagan. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. And the theme this week is assisting clients in the chronic progression of recovery. And Michael is a therapist who has been working in mental health and substance use services for quite a few years, and he works with individuals and families in a full range of services, and leads workshops, is an active trainer, clinical supervisor, and we're going to go through a lot of the different approaches. But talk about, if you would, Michael, give us an idea. What do you mean assisting clients in the chronic progression of recovery? What are we going to be talking about this week?
Well, Eddie, that concept came to me. I was working with a group the other day and was kind of explaining how addiction is often referred to as being chronic and progressive. Chronic meaning it's ongoing. It's not acute. And progressive, that it progresses over time. And I had this kind of sinking feeling as I looked at the faces of the clients, and something hit me to say, but here's the good news. Recovery is also chronic and progressive. And that's what I try to present to clients that I work with, that there's hope.
So, you know, addiction is a serious matter, and it does progress over time.
Mm-hmm.
But so does recovery.
That's right.
So does recovery. And I think we've all seen that in our experiences. So you're a therapist, and you have your own business, Second Spring Counseling. Did I say that right?
That's correct, yes.
And it's here in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yes, it is.
And you also work in some different facilities that provide services for people in recovery as well.
Yes, I do a group and some individual work contract to Legacy Freedom Treatment Centers.
Yes. So how did you get interested in this? Is this something, you know, this is a caring profession, and it's a difficult work in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
When did you decide that you wanted to do some kind of career like this?
Well, I think it kind of progressed over time. I went to undergrad school and studied philosophy. So I've always been someone who's really asked the deeper questions and have always been an inward-looking person. And I continued on after undergrad school and worked in another field for many years. And I also struggled on and off with substance use and abuse. And as I got a bit older, I finally found recovery in from the abuse of substances that I was using. And I began to really wake up to who I really am and ask myself, what is it that I'm really here to do? And I discovered that counseling, therapy might be a good field for me to go into. And I haven't looked back, and I decided to go back to graduate school. And it's been a wonderful journey ever since.
Now, did you grow up in this part of the country?
I didn't. I have lived in this area 37 years.
Wow.
And I
You're
hesitate.
Practically a native.
Yeah, I always hesitate because that kind of reveals some of my age, which
That's
I'm a little
right.
bit conscious of. But I moved here in my 20s, and I've seen lots of changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in a little small town, rural community, farm town in upstate New York.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to compare notes because I grew up in upstate New York, too.
Okay.
Now, did you go to graduate school then around here?
Yes, I did. I went to Western Carolina University.
Okay.
And got a master's in counseling.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So we have a serious problem out there that doesn't seem to be getting any better, does it, Michael?
That's very apparent, yes.
Yeah. So we can throw numbers around, and maybe we should do that just a little bit in case anyone out there is not really aware of it. The number I heard was that, and it ranges, but I've heard 140 people are dying every single day in the United States just from opioid wow. overdose.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I heard just on my way over here that 80% of the people who are addicted to heroin have started out with a prescription from their doctor.
Hmm. Yeah. What have you noticed, Michael?
Yeah, I've noticed over the years that I've been doing this work, the increase in the number of people who have had opioid problems. And one of the groups that I've done for 4 to 5 years almost now is working with folks who are using Suboxone, which is a medication-assisted treatment, and I've provided group therapy and individual therapy for some of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned over these years is that, to me, I've seen there seems to be a different approach that I've found can be more helpful working with opioid addiction.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be getting into that a little bit more as we go through the different modalities that you use.
Okay.
So, if you could just sort of generalize a little bit, what do you feel, is the most effective treatment for substance use disorder?
I think it depends on the individual, first of all. But what I discovered when I first started working at an inpatient treatment facility over a couple of years' time, I began to realize that addiction seems to affect us in a subconscious way, meaning that people aren't making conscious choices to become addicted. People are making conscious choices to have fun, but mm-hmm. addiction then seems to take over. So I started seeing, it's really a subconscious kind of problem. So treating it with logical, conscious types of therapy don't seem to work very well.
Wow.
And so that began my journey into really investigating, which I had a natural tendency to do anyway, looking at how do we make contact with the subconscious?
Mm. And isn't it true that when people are in the stages of early recovery, that the part of the brain that does logical, rational thinking isn't necessarily really engaged all that much, is it?
That's right, Eddie. And what I've learned is that as soon as we take alcohol or another drug, the first part of the brain that goes offline, as I say, mm-hmm. is the prefrontal cortex,
yeah.
which is where our executive decision-making is. So after a few drinks or, a couple of pills, the decision-making gets shut down pretty quickly. And over time, that, of course, progresses.
And how much have you noticed in the work that you do with your clients, a history of trauma or adverse childhood experiences. It's referred to in different ways. How much of that have you noticed?
Well, I think it's very prevalent. I wouldn't venture to put a percentage on it, but I'd say it's more common than not common. Yeah.
And if a person is a trauma survivor, then they're probably really operating out of the part of the brain that's just trying to protect them.
Yes, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
The limbic system, so, yeah.
Correct, Margaret.
And it can be described as ritualized compulsive comfort seeking, which is a natural human desire to try to find some relief from their stress or their uncomfortable feelings, whether it's physical uncomfortable feelings or emotional uncomfortable feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I see that quite often. Once we take a look at the addictive behaviors, maybe the presenting problem, but then when we begin doing some therapy, that's what can show up quite often.
Yeah.
That there's a reason for using the substance, which would be this comfort seeking.
Yeah, who doesn't want to? Who really enjoys being uncomfortable and being in pain? It's a question of what kind of resources do we have? What kind of skill sets? What kind of coping skills? So you help them with coping skills, and you mentioned you help them understand what's lying under the conscious level, help start exploring that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your radio dial and WPVMFM.org if you want to stream us. And Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by therapist Michael Fagan. The topic is assisting clients in the chronic progression of recovery. So perhaps we might want to start exploring some of these modalities that you use. Some of these I'm familiar with, and I know Margaret is, and some of them I'm really anxious to learn more about. This is the fun part of doing this, Michael, is that we get to learn a lot from our guests. It's really great. We leave here smarter than when we walk in. It's amazing what can happen in an hour. Yeah.
There's so many cool people around.
I know. Yeah. People say, well, you do such a great show. And I go, well, we got great guests.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
he's one of them.
He's one of them. So, you know, we just keep reaching out and people keep coming in and we're grateful. Acceptance and commitment therapy. We actually had a show, oh gosh, it was over a year ago, with Joe Nijin. He came in and he talked about it. Mm-hmm. But tell us, what is that and how do you use that in the work that you do, Michael?
Well, acceptance commitment therapy is more of a behavioral approach. So it is very helpful the way I use it in more of the understanding coping skills, and it's sort of a what people call third wave cognitive behavioral therapy, but it adds in the beauty of mindfulness and understanding who we really are. Because oftentimes, I might veer off a little bit here if that's okay. Mm-hmm. When I say to people, so you're in recovery, and they say, yeah, and I go, so what are you recovering? And oftentimes, I get a blank stare. So let me ask you, Eddie, what are we recovering in recovery?
Well, my response is who I really am.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And who I really am, I mean, there's a spiritual dimension, so I'm really recovering that spiritual dimension.
There you go. Yeah. And that's the approach I take. And I had a feeling you might answer that way. But I think this is a big wake-up call to a lot of folks in recovery. And acceptance commitment therapy brings in the idea of me here now noticing, even though I'm feeling some of these uncomfortable feelings, you know, I also have some values, and can I move towards my values even though I'm having uncomfortable feelings, thoughts, or sensations in my body? And so that's some of the ways I use that. It's not a very in-depth explanation of the therapy, but yes.
So when you say acceptance and commitment therapy, I get the acceptance part. I'm accepting what I'm actually experiencing in this moment. But what's the commitment part of that phrase?
That's a great question. So as I said, I notice I have these uncomfortable feelings, thoughts, or sensations in my body. And I also notice I have these values in my life. Can I take committed action or one small step towards my values? That would be the committed action or commitment.
And do you start, they start looking at what their belief systems are, their stories? Is that part of it? Like, I mean, my understanding of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is limited, because I'm not a therapist, you know, is that they start understanding the thoughts in the manner of thinking and connect, you know, that have impacted the decisions that they've made that have had consequences.
Is that, help
me with that. Is that,
I'm not a cognitive behavioral therapist either. But acceptance and commitment therapy is more about understanding and it's about psychological avoidance of our thoughts or feelings or sensations that are uncomfortable. In helping move folks towards acceptance of them. In making choices to move action, committed action towards our values.
That's what we do, Margaret, right?
Yes, we do. That's what we do in meditation. That's what we do in yoga. You know, sometimes there are some postures that we move into with our bodies, and they're a little bit challenging. So we just accept where we are and our limitations, but also kind of reach into our potentials as well.
Well, I have a phrase that I frequently use in the groups that I do. In fact, if they've been there quite a while, sometimes some of the clients will finish the sentence for me. Margaret knows what I'm going to say. But that is that if we're going to stay in recovery, if we're going to figure out how not to use, we have to be okay with being uncomfortable.
It
doesn't mean we like it. We certainly don't seek it out. But when it happens, that's what we're doing, right?
And the key component, which I said at the beginning, which I like about ACT or acceptance and commitment therapy, is it brings in the idea of who we really are, who's really making the decisions, who's able to sit and notice that I'm having uncomfortable feelings or uncomfortable thoughts or uncomfortable sensations in my body.
So are you asking them to check into their bodies and notice what's happening?
Absolutely.
That can be really, really empowering. I know it has been for me to discover that things are not just randomly happening to me, that I'm an actual participant in my own experience.
And when you work with people in recovery, are some of them in brand new recovery, like pretty much straight out of detox, some of them, or are they further down the road? Or
Yes, sometimes. I would say all over the map.
And those who are especially early recovery, do you find them resistant or, I don't know if another word, do they have difficulty trying to access what's going on in their body?
Yes, sometimes. And I appreciate that you kind of took back that word resistant. Because my approach to, there is no such thing as a resistant client. It's only, then I need to make a change in my approach.
Say more about that if you would.
So, bringing in ideas from, say, motivational interviewing, meeting the client where they are and helping them to move to another a stage of change. So motivational interviewing brings in the idea of the different stages of change, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and then maintenance. So assessing where a client is. So as you talked about, the client that we might consider resistant may just be a pre-contemplative client.
So what does that mean?
It means the client isn't really sure he's got a problem. He or she has a problem.
I drink. I've got a couple of DUIs. But, you know, I haven't lost my job yet. And my wife hasn't left me. So
there you go.
Get off my butt. I'm doing okay.
Right. So in that stage, the approach I might take is just simple reflection. Oh, I hear you. So you've had a couple of DWIs and your wife is bugging you about it. But she's still here. But she hasn't left you yet. And so you don't really see that you have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when we begin to meet clients where they are, then they begin to maybe process, well, maybe I don't know. Maybe I do, maybe I don't.
And now is that contemplation now?
Then we move into, contemplation. So maybe I do, maybe I don't.
Yeah. So you explore that with them.
That's right. Right.
Okay. So you're asking questions. See, when I heard of motivational interviewing,
yes,
I thought that was training people how to go for a job interview. I was like, no, that's not what it is.
Yeah.
So you're asking questions and giving feedback.
Yes. And it relies heavily on reflection, affirmation, summarizing, mm-hmm. Concepts such as that to let the client know. Which I say oftentimes, my approach often is I really want to understand what's going on with you. Like somebody may come in and say, I'm really angry. Well, I know what angry is like. And I'm quick to say, well, I know what being angry is like. I know how to fix that for you. But I don't necessarily know what anger is like for this client. So
So
I hear that you're really feeling angry. Tell me more about that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what's anger like for you? Because I don't know what it's like for you.
So how important is that they feel heard? That's called a softball, in case you're wondering.
I kind of took that by the wink. What was the question?
Oh, how important is that they actually feel heard?
Let's just say it's the whole ball of wax.
It isn't. It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially since, in many cases, people have been very critical and judgmental of them.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's a compassionate approach.
Absolutely. And one of the first trainings that I ever took was in Hakomi. And it informs probably most of everything I do. And the Hakomi method is about holding a loving presence, which is compassionate, a loving presence, like being fully present with loving, compassionate care. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean that I'm trying to fix or, you know, change or do anything. I'm just holding presence so that the client has the opportunity to explore what they need to explore.
I'm wondering if you might give an example of someone you worked with using that Hakomi method and what that might sound like, look like.
Yeah. So a client comes in and he's really struggling with his father, his adolescent client, and he's really complaining and nobody listens to him. And his dad, he's angry at his dad. His dad's trying to control him all the time. And so I'm...
You're describing somebody I know.
Yeah, okay. And so I would sit in the way I experience loving presence in myself when a client's doing that is I'm sitting in emptiness almost. There is no judgment in me of father, of son, of anybody. And I'm just holding a presence in my body, in my stature, in my being. And it's sort of an emptiness, but I'm completely present. And the idea of it that I've experienced, like with this client, is you could see the client begin to relax after the story gets told. And I haven't said a word even yet. But there's a sense of connection already being made.
How do you do that? Do you go into Zen?
Many years of practice, many years. I really practiced a lot of this in when I worked at the inpatient rehab in mm-hmm. Black Mountain and did some lots of group therapy every day and began to practice going in there with no agendas, no ideas of what I was going to say or do, but holding this presence.
I mean, I was kind of making a joke, but I mean, do you actually do like a mindfulness practice before a group?
Or a breath practice.
Anything like that?
I guess I do, but I, you know, it's hard to describe it. Mm-hmm. Pretty much I can sit like I've been doing as I'm talking about it. I've sat up and got more, you know, present in mm-hmm. my body. I keep I keep showing you my hands around
I noticed that.
Going up and down the center of my body. And then also I tune in to a higher power mm-hmm. that it's not me doing things here. I'm an open vessel, an empty vessel. I have many years of practice in Qigong practices.
Oh, yeah.
And so the empty vessel, it's sort of a felt sense in my body of being empty but full and, mm-hmm. and you know, present. So that's, I can touch on a little bit.
Wow. Way. So where did that come from? I mean, it sounds Japanese, Hakomi, to me.
Well, it's I can't say for sure. The word came to someone. Ron Kurtz was the originator of Hakomi, and he was out in Oregon, and that's who I actually studied under for a short time. And one of his students, when he was first developing this method, had a dream one night, and the word Hakomi came to him.
Hmm.
And then I can't quite remember the...
Okay.
But it's like an Indian word.
Well, I've met a few people who do Hakomi. I never really got to understand it, but some of them also do other practices like somatic experiencing. Mm-hmm. And the organic Scott,
organic intelligence.
He uses Hakomi,
something like that, where you are observing your clients' very subtle, small, simple body movements.
Yes, tracking,
and maybe even commenting on their movements and encouraging that they're looking for the pleasantness or the calmness and the centeredness within themselves.
So, you know, I can't actually do the textbook version, but it's the loving presence and then really tracking clients, watching body movements, body orientation, then coming up with experiments. Like if I see a certain body movement that's connected to what they're talking about, invite them to do a little experiment. And then that's where you kind of through the body get to the subconscious extremely quickly.
That sounds so cool. I want to learn more about that.
Yeah, that does sound cool. So if the client is doing something with their hands, you might encourage them to do a little experiment, maybe intensify that or repeat
it. Exactly, Margaret. Yeah, you would have them. It depends in the moment you come up with the experiment, but that would be exaggerate or minimize or say something over and over. There's different experiments.
So like you're giving feedback.
Yes.
And then letting them work through that. Wow, that's really great. Well, we're going to pause for just a brief piece of music. You're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And Margaret and I are going to return with our guest, Michael Fagan, in just a couple of minutes. I picked out a piece of music by jazz pianist Bill Evans doing a Thelonious Monk tune, which I hope you'll enjoy. Thank you. Andrea Bill Evans, not sounding that much like Bill Evans, but when you play Thelonious Monk, anything can happen. This is Eddie LeSurin from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM. Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in Monday nights from 7 to 8 and Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 for the rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. And it's easy to locate them. You just go to WPVMFM.org. You click on the schedule and select this program, which is listed Mondays at 7 p.m. We're broadcasting live December 11th, 2017, and this is program 101. Woo-hoo. Yeah. All our shows are made possible by a Mindful Emergence LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can access more information online about us at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And by the way, when you're on the WPVMFM.org website, feel free, if you want to help keep community radio on the air, to make a tax-deductible donation. We are a 501c3. We're all volunteers here. So, and if you want to do a show or get involved with some in some way at WPVM, just take a look at the website and you'll see opportunities there where you can volunteer as well as donate. So let's return back to our guest, therapist Michael Fagan, talking about assisting clients in the chronic progression of recovery. So in this progression that you notice with individuals recovering from substance or behavioral addictions, what are some of the things that you notice about them as they go through this chronic progression of recovery?
That's a great question, Eddie. I think one of the first things that I begin to notice is a little bit of what I might call affect regulation, where folks come in and, you know, it's just really hard even being in their bodies and dealing with life, dealing with other people in their lives, paying their bills, all kinds of stuff. So just helping the begin to regulate their nature, their affect, their emotions, their thinking, all that kind of stuff.
Calming the nervous system.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, self-regulation.
Yeah, self-regulation.
Yeah,
and
oh, wow.
Yeah.
So can you give us an example of something you might do? Or, Margaret, feel free to chime in as well.
I was just going to say that sometimes with the substances, don't they affect the nervous system and
absolutely.
The brain in ways that makes it really difficult
absolutely.
To think and plan and reason?
And certainly uncomfortable to be in their bodies.
Yeah, yes. Physical sensations.
That hurt when I was in my body. What are you talking about getting in my body? I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's why I used.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you show them another way.
Well, in a sense, first I kind of am assessing, I'm considering what was the substance being used and what effect did it have on the body and the nervous system and what effects are showing up in the client and being, again, present with that, not rushing too fast, but, you know, monitoring how you're feeling today, what's going on physically, mentally, emotionally. Those kinds of things. And then over time, as the substances, the longer the substances are out of a person's body, then they begin to regulate a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And then we might approach, you know, what are some of the emotional things that are showing up? Because that's usually what they begin to present with.
Yeah, and the emotions really come at them fast and furious.
Yes, yes. And anger, quite often, is one of the most... The top most presented problems emotionally at first.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a client today and he came in and there was some, he had stopped using substances actually for a while now, but at this time, you know, it's been over a year. Things have been going okay. Life is back on track a little bit. But he's seeking out some therapy because he's noticing some anger showing up. And where's all this anger and all these other emotions coming from?
And that's part of the progression.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Is it actually necessary to know why and to analyze where the emotion is coming from? Or is it enough to just accept that it's there and endeavor to move in a positive direction?
That's a great question. And I'm not one who thinks the why question's that important, because we can get the answer to why, but does it help? It's more of a how question, isn't it, Margaret?
Yeah.
It's like, how did this thing start? How do I deal with it? How do I accept that occasionally I get angry about things?
Yeah, I used to spend a lot of time hanging out in my head. And I mean, I actually thought if I read enough books and if I spent enough time thinking about it, I would figure out the meaning of life and how life works, and everything would be fine. Of course, I wasn't really in contact with my feelings and getting in my body, maybe not so good.
But
then I found recovery, and that helped. But boy, the emotions, they really came up. And you want to be supportive.
Absolutely.
Give them skills.
Absolutely. Understanding and supportive in a way that they folks begin to feel it's okay. It's actually normal. Oftentimes I'll say something like this, that, you know, well, you're a human being. You're going to experience this full range of emotions, and that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And some of them aren't comfortable.
Yeah.
But they're kind of what's installed in the system. And sometimes the only kind of why that I might get into is I kind of take an approach of understanding how, like the owner's manual, sometimes I call it. It's like how the system is made up and how it operates. Like, we know how our cars run, and yet we don't necessarily know how does our own body systems operate.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Once we become familiar with that, it becomes less threatening or frightening or uncomfortable. It's,
and normalizing
this
stuff. Yeah.
How might you work with someone who comes in and has a lot of anger and they're really feeling kind of charged up? Or maybe on the other end of the spectrum, how might you work with someone who's kind of lethargic and isolated and really not wanting to engage so much? What might you do when they're in that state?
Wow.
One of those states.
That's not a softball.
No, it's not. I mean, I want to ask the big questions and get some real solid answers.
Let's talk about the anger. So somebody who's really angry, I think it's important that they are able to talk what they're angry about.
Yeah.
So, and then oftentimes I kind of shine a light, is what I say, that, wow, you have a lot of insight and you're doing really good telling me about your anger, like what that's like for you, but you're not actually yelling and screaming and hitting people.
Mm-hmm.
This is gigantic, you know? And so oftentimes I'm really shining a light, I call it, helping people see, oh, wow, you're right. You know, I'm talking about it, not taking a baseball bat to this guy's car, you know?
So they're creating evidence for themselves that they can actually manage it.
Yes. Absolutely. That's one approach that I would use.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You've mentioned before getting into the subconscious aspect of it. So let's dive into that. And I know one of the techniques you use is RRT, Rapid Resolution Therapy. Now, this is something I don't know anything at all about, so I'm really eager to learn. Tell us about this, Michael.
So Rapid Resolution Therapy, by its name, of course, implies that it's rapid. And the approach is the goal is not to have many, many sessions. The goal is to kind of clear up any blocks in a person's subconscious that is blocking them from living a full and functional life. So what it is, it's a more directive kind of therapy. It does involve some hypnosis, which I'm clinically certified as a National Board Certified Clinical Hypnotherapist, which is not a stage hypnotist, by the way. There is a difference.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it involves some hypnosis. If each session is different, it involves using therapeutic metaphor, and it approaches the subconscious in a more direct way. And it's sort of unique. It's not like regular therapy where we're talking in content.
Give me an example of how that might work, a situation where you might go to that.
Well, where I found it most effective is I've had clients come in who have had like early childhood sexual trauma. And so there's to begin with, there might be a little bit of talking about how the mind works in the, you know, a little bit of education, what I might call the owner's manual. That's what I call it, in describing how our minds work, the emotional mind versus the cognitive thinking mind. And then describing in kind of metaphorical ways when trauma occurs. It's like if you've ever been behind the scenes in a post office where a guy's putting the mail away, he's really good. He gets to put the mail away. He gets 3 hours. They say, "Joe, here's all the mail." And he takes 3 hours and he puts all the mail perfectly in all the slots. And then come Christmas time, there's five times the amount of mail comes in. He's only got 3 hours to put it away. What's he going to do?
Uh-oh.
He starts doing as fast as he can. Some of it doesn't get put in the right spots, and a whole bunch of it gets left laying on the floor.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what trauma is like.
Oh.
Because there's so much coming into the system, too much, too fast. It doesn't get sorted properly. And there's a whole bunch kind of hanging out on the floor.
Body doesn't get right, is not in regulation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great way to describe it.
That's great.
Yeah. And so the approach, this RRT approach, this is just a generalized idea, is the approach that I take is to how do we help clear up what's left on the floor, get everything sorted into the right place so that it gets put back in the memory and it's what we might call reconsolidated, so that it's not attached to the uncomfortable traumatic emotions. And so in general, that's the approach. And there's different techniques that are used that are confuses the mind a little bit, and that's the way it gets cleared up. It's
okay.
Like clearing up.
Now, this is something you would do one-on-one.
Absolutely.
But not in a group.
No, no, this is one-on-one therapy.
Yeah.
Is it at all similar to EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing?
Yeah, in its how could I best say this? No.
Very simple and direct.
That might be the best way to say it. No, no, it's different.
It's different.
But what I, the reason I hesitated, honestly, is that any effective therapy that deals with trauma seems to have some certain characteristics that are similar. Mm-hmm. The techniques might be different.
Okay.
Like EMDR does it differently, and they use some eye movements, and they have a whole protocol. And RRT has a protocol that the technique is different, but generally, if we think about trauma, it's about the memory comes up, it's attached to this very uncomfortable feeling.
Sure.
And so each approach is using that, how to take that memory to reattach new emotion to it that's not as threatening and scary, and then it gets put back in memory. It's called memory reconsolidation.
Yeah, I've heard, I forget which type of therapy it was, someone said it takes information that was stored in our limbic system, which is, you know, the fight or flight part of the brain, and it takes that and refiles it in the part of the brain that stores phone numbers, which is the rational part of the brain, right?
I would think
so. Would you say that's a good metaphor?
It sounds reasonable.
Okay.
No, it does,
Yeah, yeah, I kind of liked it. It made sense to me.
Yeah.
So if you're listening in, this is A Mindful Emergence. Margaret and I are joined this week by Michael Fagan. Assisting clients in the chronic progression of recovery is the focus here on WPVM. And by the way, if you like this show, I invite you to check in with WPVM on Thursdays from 5 to 6 when McNair Ezard hosts A Better World. And that's a show where he brings in people and organizations that are working in areas like hunger and poverty, economic social justice, the environment, and spirituality. And his show, as well as this one, are interviews with people who are making a difference out there. And next week's program, which will be program 102, we've got Kim May coming in, talking about recovering personal power through physical, emotional, and spiritual practices. So that'll be coming up on, let's see, a week from today is the 18th, I believe, of December. Nonviolent communication is another approach that you use. Tell us about that, Michael.
Yes, nonviolent communication was developed by Marshall Rosenberg, and it's a fairly simple but effective way to communicate. It's sort of a four-step process of
Four-step process.
Yeah.
You did it. You took that training, Margaret. You remember?
That's why I was looking to her.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. But basically, the core of it is talking about our feelings and our needs. And so when I present it, helping people understand, especially in couples therapy, I tend to use this a little bit. We don't go into great detail, but understanding, Marshall has a great way of saying this, that we get in touch with what's alive inside us. So I really want to know what's alive inside you. I want to know what's alive inside me. And the core of that is, generally speaking, our feelings. And feelings are intrinsically connected to our needs. So if it's an uncomfortable feeling, our needs are not being met. If it's a comfortable feeling, our needs are being met. And so learning how to effectively get in touch with that and then communicate it to people that we care about can be really helpful.
So you're teaching this, you're explaining this, helping your clients use this in their life.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And how to be more effective in communicating what they want to communicate to each other. One of the key things that I find with using this is that we can often identify an uncomfortable feeling, and then we jump into all the reasons why I'm feeling so uncomfortable, which are negative.
Mm-hmm.
And with nonviolent communication, it's more about expressing what I hope for, what I need,
yeah,
what I want, what I value, what I dream for. So if I'm feeling really sad because I really do want to connect with you, sounds a whole lot different than I'm really sad because you said this thing to
me,
you were so mean to me, that kind of stuff.
So we take the blaming out.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that definitely creates a different dynamic.
Yeah.
When you said that, I felt this way. Would that be a statement? Like, when you said that or when you did this, I really felt hurt. Is that, would that be a good approach?
Well, the core, step two and three, are feelings and needs. Step one is about observation, observing.
Mm-hmm.
What did I hear?
I heard you say this.
Or see, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than evaluating.
So that's less judgmental.
Yes, evaluating is what we tend
to. So rather than saying, when you said that, I felt angry.
Yes.
You might say, well, I heard you say that.
Yes.
And the way I heard that.
Yes.
I felt angry.
It could be like that.
Something like that, maybe. And
yeah,
then
it's like, you know, when I hear you say blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm,
and you repeat exactly what they say, I feel this.
And this is my experience.
Yes.
And then you express a need, so
yes,
that might be something like,
because I really want to connect with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not getting, you say it in the positive way.
Yeah.
This is what I really want.
I want to hear what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And then the final step is you make a request if you want to,
mm-hmm, okay,
rather than a demand.
Right.
Versus a demand. So you request,
yeah,
so would you be willing to speak to me in a lower tone of voice and et cetera?
Yeah. Well, gee, how could you go wrong? I mean, that's a great skillful approach.
It really does. It comes across so much more softly and smoothly.
Yeah.
And so the other person can really receive it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see that being effective in the couples work you do?
I do. And I think what's important is the generalized idea behind it, getting in touch with what's alive inside me.
Mm-hmm.
I call it a lot of inner work. So I think the most important thing is to understand, what am I feeling and what is it that I really want that I'm not getting?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the what I need or want is basic human needs, not I want you to do something. It's I want peace. I want connection.
Yeah, yeah.
I want love. I want...
And really what we all want is we want to feel love. We want to feel connected.
Yes, absolutely.
And sometimes we just don't know how to do that.
Yes, which reminds me of that wonderful quote I heard from Gabor Mate: the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, and I heard it in just a slightly different way. The disease of addiction is an attempt to solve the problem of disconnection.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we all share that love affair with Gabor Mate. He was amazing. Did you get a chance to go see him when he came to town last year?
I did not. I didn't know he was here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully he'll be back.
Okay.
He had a big turnout.
Email me next time.
I will.
All these great people come.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad you weren't there. You didn't get a chance to hear him process me in front of 300 people.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How'd that go?
It was a very interesting.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it caught me by surprise, but it was good.
Is it on tape somewhere?
I don't think so.
It's not. It's his own personal experience.
But I have people come up to me and say, yeah, I was at the thing when Gabor Mate was.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
It was pretty interesting. Let's talk a little bit more before I forget. They can get more information about your work at your website. If you could please give out that link.
Yes, it's secondspringcounseling.com.
Pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Second spring counseling.com.
Yes,
and you work with people who are dealing with DUI offenses?
Yes, I also do... In North Carolina, we call it DWI, driving while impaired. It used to be DUI, but now it's DWI. Yes, I do DWI assessments, and I do DWI treatment groups.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who gets a DWI in North Carolina, if they will eventually lose their license once they're convicted. And if you want to get the return of your license, the state law says you must get a substance abuse assessment by a DWI provider. I'm not the only one. There's a number of us in town.
Mm-hmm.
And you must follow the recommendations of the assessment. And we are trained. The recommendation is always for a certain number of hours of groups that you must attend.
Okay. And they can get that information on the website.
They can, absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about 12-step recovery.
Okay.
Because you do, when it's appropriate, integrate that into the other work that you do. How do you see that overlapping?
Yes. Well, first of all, if a client is open to 12-step ideas or 12-step recovery or groups, I believe that it's very helpful to explain some of the fundamental concepts and ideas behind it. First and foremost, I consider 12-step groups to be awesome support groups.
Yeah.
And that there are other support groups, but I think part of recovery, of course, an integral part of recovery is getting some kind of support outside of family.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a hard concept for people to understand, but getting support outside of family can be very helpful in the recovery process.
Community.
It's
connection. Critical.
Back to what Margaret was saying, connection.
Connection, community.
Yes.
It seems like recovery is very difficult without connection and community.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And I think that's the core thing about the connection. And the way that I often describe it to folks who come in and a little early on is that the progression of addiction tends to progress to more and more isolation, and you know, being less and less honest with the people that we love, less connected, more isolated. Almost everybody would agree with that. They tend to shake their heads and go, "Yeah, I've experienced that." So the chronic progression of recovery would be, let's go the opposite way. And why research also shows us that group work in substance use seems to be most effective.
Yes.
Why? Because we're learning how to, again, reconnect with sure. other people, be vulnerable, see that we're not alone, many other things like that.
That's a big deal, isn't it? I mean, you must get people coming in and they think, oh, I'm the only one that's this messed up.
Absolutely.
I'm the only yes. one that did that. And then yes. they find out, oh, no.
Yes. Yes. And so there's that I'm not alone, that I can actually be vulnerable and share some of my feelings in a safe way, and mm-hmm. I'm accepted, I'm not judged,
right?
And deal with my guilt and shame and say, oh, yeah, you've experienced that too. You feel that also.
And you can hear how other people have dealt with those kind of situations.
Yes.
Maybe just by sitting there and listening, it's yes. like, oh, wow, that person has a similar situation, and look what they did. Yeah. Maybe I might want to try that.
And you can actually see the progression of recovery in some individuals who've been a little bit further down the path.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you bump into people that you'd work with years ago, and they now come up to you and go, hey, look at me. Look what I'm doing now.
It has happened, and quite often I'll be in a parking lot or somewhere. Somebody rushes up to me. This has happened more than once, and I go, remind me who you are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that happens to
and
us.
And then I go, oh, yeah. And then I'm always pleased yeah. to hear that they're doing well.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's great. Miracles are happening all the time. There's a lot of tragedy out there. There are
yes.
a lot, but, oh, man, there are miracles. Recovery does happen.
Yes, it does. And it is chronic in the sense that it is something that recovery is an active thing that a person will work upon throughout their life.
Yes.
It may look different for each of us. It doesn't all look the same. But if there's attention paid to it, we could call it, it's chronic recovery, because I'm constantly
yeah.
moving forward, working on moving forward.
You don't just become, you don't become recovered once and for all.
Right. That, yeah. I'm
some fixed. People think they do, and that's a big...
you don't get fixed.
Yeah, you don't get fixed. Yeah, it's
in
a
that
constant,
classic sense of getting fixed.
Constant evolution and progression.
A good friend of mine shared this metaphor with me that I always liked, is that you're like riding a bicycle up a hill. You mm-hmm. have to work at it.
Yeah.
And if you stop pedaling, what happens?
Yeah.
You tend to go
that's
back.
That's another great, yeah. that's great. Great yeah. example. Michael Fagan, thank you so much for coming on to A Mindful Emergence. We really appreciate it. You've offered so much. And we acknowledge you for the great work that you're doing out there in the community.
Well, I appreciate both you and Margaret, Eddie. I think you're doing great work here.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
This program.
Thank you. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in once again. And again, next week, Kim May, Recovering Personal Power Through Physical, Emotional, and Spiritual Practices. Take care, and look forward to you joining us again next time on A Mindful Emergence.